Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all. I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. John T. Edge has thought more and more deeply about Southern food than maybe anyone else in the world. He's been director of the Southern Foodways Alliance since its beginning and has led the movement to understand who we are in the South through what we eat. He's also the author of a book that came out this year called The Potlicker Papers, which traces the history of the modern South through the cooks, chefs, and celebrities who shape the way we see our culture. John T. spoke to us from the Southern Foodways Alliance office in Oxford, Mississippi. Here's our conversation. Oh, by the way, one heads up, there are a couple of words in here that might not be suitable for all listeners. John T., where are you from and what was it like there when you were growing up?
I grew up in about a 50-person town, about 25 old houses and about 25 new trailers. Clinton, Georgia, near Macon, just barely north of Macon, about 12 miles. And I grew up country, I mean, real country, like riding around the back of pickup trucks, country, riding my bike to a barbecue joint down the road, country. And it was, you know, I loved it, but I also wanted out pretty quick, like a lot of boys from the South. And I didn't really know until later why I wanted out. I figured that out as I got older.
Yeah. What was that barbecue joint?
It's called Old Clinton Barbecue. And, I mean, just the approach is, it was kind of an idealized barbecue joint. There were cedar posts in a gravel lot holding up a tin roof with sawdust that was on the floor inside and spilled out onto the little porch out front. They had one of those dogleg flue cookers. It was a basically poured concrete with a smoke box at the end, at one end, and a fuel source at the other. Smoke box where the shoulders sat. Really cooked. They cooked butts, is what they called them. I'd get a barbecue sandwich with a kind of a sauce that to North Carolina would look kind of like Piedmont sauce, ketchup and vinegar.
You talked about the, you know, the dog leg flu and all that stuff. Was that stuff that you were paying attention to even when you were a kid?
It's a great question, Tommy. I guess I was. I mean, I remember the kind of sight line of that flu, and it was so dominant in that space. It looked odd, you know. It looked somehow industrial in the middle of this kind of very non-industrial space. So I remember the dog leg flu, but more than that, I remember Miss Coulter, and she, you know, as a boy, she always looked old to me. But she had gray hair piled up on top of her head, and she had little granny glasses, and she'd worked the counter. And obviously there were men, and these were African-American men who worked the pits. Miss Coulter chopped the meat. Miss Coulter was white. And Miss Coulter, like, worked this cleaver, you know, and I can picture Miss Coulter, like, whacking into that pork butt with a cleaver and the shards of meat flying. If anything captured my attention, it was her, because she was both this really comforting presence in my life, this woman who fed me, and this woman who worked a menacing cleaver.
Yeah, I think maybe one thing people don't realize when they just go to the barbecue joint as much is how much work is involved in making it right.
Yeah, and that's what we really value, I think. We don't tend to see barbecue that way. I mean, now after thinking and writing about food for a good long while now, I mean, that's what I think of most when I think about barbecue. I think about the labor, and not brute labor, not about just who can stay up all night and who can shovel coals hour after hour after hour, but the expertise and labor that you garner over decades of, you know, standing in the smoke, working in the smoke. And that labor is what makes barbecue such a totemic, important food. And I think we're only beginning to realize that as the pit master becomes kind of a cultural icon in the South.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how about when you were at home growing up? Was there like, were there good cooks in your family? Were there like specialty dishes? Is there something that's sort of the sort of iconic thing that you remember having when you were at home as a kid?
I mean, there are a couple. My mother made a great catfish stew. She had, as a child, her family had a fish camp on the Edisto River in South Carolina, not far from Orangeburg. And they made catfish stew, and it was, you know, it was catfish cut into steaks, you know, into with a bone in the middle, that style of catfish stew,
right,
with tomatoes and onions. And there's actually in our kitchen in Oxford now, my cousin gave me my mother's recipe for catfish stew written out in her hand, which is framed next to our stove. That recipe, that dish, is something we carry on today. My wife cooks it. You know, it's changed a little bit. It's not catfish steaks, but fillets, and you know, the chicken stock base. And she really kind of combined my mother's recipe with a recipe from Scott Peacock and Edna Lewis, the kind of Miss Lewis being one of the kind of grand dames of Southern cooking. So in a way, we keep that recipe, my mother's recipe, my mother's family recipe, alive, and have adapted it for modern day Mississippi.
It's funny, I think catfish is such an iconic thing. If you grew up near the water in the South, I grew up down the coast of Georgia, and you know, I've always told people that if I end up on death row, my last meal is going to be, you know, fried catfish and hush puppies. And that's because that's what we made all the time. It was, you know, you talk in this book about sort of how shrimp and grits evolved and how it became such a signature dish of the South. And in our house, shrimp and grits is what you made if there was nothing else in the house, because that's two things you always had, you know, growing up on the coast. And I know you talk about how that sort of became kind of from a real working class dish to something that became, you know, a big deal in fancier restaurants too.
Yeah, that's a pretty typical pattern for a provincial dish, a working class dish, which is essential and delicious, that is adopted by the middle class and transformed by way of plating or garnish or even setting, putting it in a restaurant as opposed to a home table or kitchen table. That's kind of the way cuisines evolve.
Now, I know me and you overlapped at the University of Georgia for a little while. We did not know each other back then, but we were both around in the early 80s. And in your book, you mentioned a place that I only vaguely knew about called the Open House. Could you just talk about that a little bit, about your experience with it and what you learned of kind of the history of it?
Yeah, so the Open House, owned by a woman named Blanche Guest, was the late night drunk purgatory for the University of Georgia.
That's kind of how segment. I remember it too, yeah.
You know, it was the place when you're all tore up, you show up at the door of Blanche's for grits and eggs. She did a goat meat omelet, I remember too.
Oh, wow.
There was some, you know, there was a real kind of country come to town aspect about Blanche's. You know, when I was in Athens, it didn't open until evening and then stayed open all night. I mean, it was designed to be the late night dive.
Right.
And I went off to college at 17. I was far from ready. And my father told me explicitly to stay the hell away from that place.
Which, of course, made you definitely want to go there, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I don't know how premeditated my attendance at Blanche's late night was, and or whether I just followed the other drunks there as a freshman. But I went there, and that became a regular kind of Saturday night place where we'd go drop quarters in the Juke and get a sausage and cheese omelet and grits. And Blanche would cuss you, and because we'd all be acting the fool, and Blanche would cuss people, and that was part of the entertainment. She seemed to be in on that joke. Everybody, you know, it was a give and take. And you know, I exited the University of Georgia without ever thinking about what my father had said to me. As I started later in life reckoning with with my own role in the South and with the places I'd called home, I started digging around in the history of Blanches. And I knew an inkling even when my father told me not to go there. And he referenced this moment. When I was a young boy, my father worked for the federal court system. He was a probation parole officer, federal probation and parole officer. And as a boy, I had gone with him to Athens, a young boy, when Herbert Guest, who had, along with Blanche, owned the open house at one point, when Herbert Guest had been prosecuted in part as an accomplice to the murder of Lemuel Penn, the U.S. officer who was pulled over on a road outside of Athens.
Like a military officer, right? He was like...
Yeah, he was a U.S. military officer. And Mr. Penn was pulled over on a road outside of Athens and shot in the head and killed. And Herbert Guest had been a part of that cadre of men who was prosecuted for that murder. And I learned as I dug that that murder was arguably planned and hatched and celebrated at Blanche's open house. It was in essence, a Klan extension, a Clavering extension. It was the kitchen for the Clavering. That kind of reckoning for me is at the heart of why I wrote this book, an attempt to look closely and be honest about the South using this cultural product, food, which we often think of in romantic ways, in soft focus, kind of nostalgic ways. But I think if you use food as a way of thinking about identity and history and the legacy of injustice in the South, food offers us new ways to apprehend that. And that one small example, that one restaurant in my own history of going to Blanche's late night, kind of denying the history of that place, even though I had an inkling of it, even though I'd sat through that trial and knew who the guests were, only later was I willing to face down what role that restaurant played in the life of the South. And here I was, a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, 19-year-old witting accomplice to that bullshit.
Now, do you remember when you started thinking about Southern food in that way as more than just, you know, something good to eat?
Couple ways to answer that. When I lived in Atlanta right after college, so it was the mid-80s, my friend Greg Colson and I used to take, you know, kind of two-hour lunches, because at that point neither one of us really cared about the job we had, but it was a good job, you know, and we'd take detours to barbecue joints. We'd drive up Buford Highway in Atlanta and go in search of great pho at a Vietnamese restaurant or Szechuan chicken. You know, we became interested in food as more than just sustenance. We became interested in food as kind of a cultural exploration. But it wasn't until I moved here to Oxford to get a master's degree in Southern Studies that I realized that I could think about food in the same way other people think about other cultural outputs like literature or music. I mean, this program, the Southern Studies program at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, taught me how to read my region and think about the cultural outputs of it. And I didn't even recognize it was a possibility of studying food as anthropology or as history until I showed up here.
Now, obviously, your book is called The Potlicker Papers. I guess for maybe people who don't, who might be listening to this from other parts of the country or whatever, just tell people real quick what potlicker is.
Sure. So when you cook greens, and to a lesser degree beans too, we think about it this way. When you cook greens with a hunk of pork and you boil them down, when they reduce down, the liquid at the bottom of the pot, the kind of leavings at the bottom of the pot after you pull the greens out, after you've served them, that liquid remainder at the bottom of the pot, the kind of distilled essence of that pot of greens and that hunk of pork, is the pot liquor. And for me, writing this book, that was kind of a metaphor for the book. I took 60 years of Southern history and boiled it down. And what do you get at the bottom of the pot? What's the essence of the South? It also served this purpose of kind of thinking about racism and its impact, too, when you reckon with the reality that during enslavement, slave owners would, in essence, get African-American housekeepers, cooks, to cook greens for them. They would take the greens, the actual physical greens, and deign to give the pot liquor, the liquid, to the enslaved. The masters didn't know that all the nutrients resided in the pot liquor, in the liquid at the bottom of the bowl. So there's a kind of subversive beauty in that the slave masters said, okay, this you take this worthless pot liquor. We want the rich greens, when in reality the enslaved ended up with the good stuff. They ended up with the pot liquor.
I thought of that when you talked about it that way. I thought about it sort of in the same way I think about barbecue and so mm-hmm. many other foods, not just in the South, certainly, but I think of it as a Southern thing, that people over all these decades have figured out how to take, like, the cheapest cut of meat or the greens or the stuff nobody wanted out of the pot and make something magical out of it. And it seems like that's a story that kind of repeats over and over. I mean, you see that too?
Yeah, I mean, the South is a place where poverty-engendered creativity has reached its ultimate form. You know, there's so many ways in which poverty and racism and all the horrors that we Southerners have endured, black and white, and now people of many hues, but out of that adversity has come beauty. Responses to that adversity have yielded beauty. And that applies to cooking, that applies to music, that applies to literature, it applies to all the ways we express ourselves. And you know, I don't think we often frame it that way, but the reality is we have taken situations that have limited us and we have transcended them, and it doesn't explain away the horrors that we've endured, but it does show the kind of inventiveness and beauty that the human condition can wrest from tough times.
Before I get too far away from pot liquor, something I did not know about until I read this book, tell us about the great pot liquor debate of 1931.
So this was my master's thesis
at
the Center for the Study of Southern Culture. So, you know, in 1931, Huey Long at this point was governor of Louisiana, and he was U.S. Senator-elect from Louisiana. And, you know, this was 1931. We're in the Depression. And we're in prohibition as well. So you can't drink and you're poor as dirt. and Huey Long sells some U.S. highway bonds. Huey Long sells some state highway bonds to finance new road construction. Remember, Long was the kingfish. He was the person who stole from the rich to give to the poor. And he was building highways across Louisiana for his people to bring their farm goods to market. And Long, as kind of an aside in an AP report, Long says, of course, you know, the reason they bought these bonds is I fed them pot liquor and cornbread. Julian Harris, who was at that point, he was an editor at the Atlanta Constitution. He's the son of Joel Chandler Harris, the interpreter of the Uncle Remus tales. Julian Harris, in response to an AP report about Long's sale of those highway bonds, Julian Harris takes issue with how Long eats his cornbread, and it's an invented moment. It's, you know, it is similar. It's a way to broadcast that kind of common man stance that these two men would argue about how to eat cornbread, whether you dunk or crumble cornbread into pot liquor. That's the debate. But it's completely farcical. And yet, what happens is over 600 letters to the editor arrive at the Atlanta Constitution. Movie reels, those shorts that appear before movies, are filmed all across the country. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because of his association with Warm Springs in Georgia, steps in to offer his opinion. The New York Times covers this event. It becomes kind of a cause célèbre in the moment, and it's diversionary. You know, it's a way not to talk about the ills of prohibition, not to talk about the ills of poverty in the Depression. It's a diversion. And this diversion, though, you see people writing in these letters, and they talk about all those things that we still debate now. They talk about identity. They talk about race. They talk about class. They talk about gender. And for me, as a grad student, that cache of letters and those newspaper pieces were a great way to see how people use food to express themselves.
Yeah. And I think of that debate even today, not that particular debate, but I think of things like the debate over whether to put salt or sugar in your cornbread as not only being like a matter of taste, you know, like just what tastes better to you, but also there's so much in there in terms of how you grew up and what your culture says and all that. It's that same thing has such a rich debate over something that on the surface is, you know, it's not nuclear war, but for so many people, it's so tied to their identity, right?
That's right. You know, it is, when we talk about food, we're talking about the place from which we come, the people from which we come, and that leads us straight to matters of import. They seem frivolous at first, but if you listen closely, you'll hear people talking about the things that really define us.
Coming up, John T. Edge makes the case for why Latinos are under-recognized for their impact on Southern cuisine. And he talks about working with other food writers and why they all seem to love their grandmamas. When we return on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Now, you have been with Southern Foodways Alliance pretty much since the beginning, right?
Yeah, the symposium that we stage each fall in Oxford, I started that as a grad student, and the energy kind of driven by that pulled together a 50 founders. John Edgerton and along with Natalie Dupree and others pulled together 50 founders who started the Southern Foodways Alliance the next year. So first symposium in 98, the Southern Foodways Alliance comes into being in 99.
And what was sort of the original purpose of the SFA, and how do you feel like it's changed, if at all, between then and now?
A good way of thinking about the SFA is to think about John Edgerton. Edgerton, who's born in Atlanta, has family in Kentucky, spent some time in Florida, but most of his working life was spent in Nashville. He was a journalist and social historian, and he wrote a number of books through the years, a really great library of thinking about the South. But the two primary ones were Speak Now Against the Day, which was a book about the generation before the civil rights movement in the South, and all the kind of radicals and dreamers who would have reconciled the South, would have fixed our busted wagon back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And then he wrote another great book called Southern Food at Home, on the Road, and in History. And so the SFA, in many ways, came out of those two books and came out of John's interest in those things. So from the beginning, our work has been documentary, tell stories of the South in true and new ways. And it has been reconciling, you know, this notion that, you know, our peculiar and tragic history has divided our people, and there's possibility for reconciliation on farms and in kitchens and at tables. Those two things have driven us from the beginning. I'm not saying we always get there every time, but that's been the drive.
Yeah, yeah. And I did not know the history of the sort of that Southern food book, which I knew pretty well, and sort of the issues that I guess, came up with that, and Jane and Michael Stern, who I think for many people have been the gateway into not necessarily just Southern sort of diner food, but a lot, you know, all over the country. It sounds like there were some issues there as that book was coming together.
There were that, you know, that for me too, Tommy, that, you know, their books Road Food and Good Food were in the 80s and 90s. Those were gateway books. You know, here are people who are thinking about food in an anthropological way. Here are people who appreciate small town culture. Here are people who, you know, are documenting the diners and barbecue joints and the like across the South and across the country. And I was really inspired by them too. When I, you know, kind of took my blinders off and did my best to make sense of how these stories of the South got told in that moment, I was going through papers that John Edgerton had given me, and it was a series of letters between the publisher for Edgerton, Knopf, and the Sterns, who claimed, as John Edgerton's book Southern Food was about to come out in 1987, claimed that John had lifted from them, from their books, his work to write Southern Food. And, you know, I knew John for a long while and never saw him rankled. But when I talked to him about this, reading through the papers, when I talked to him about this, you know, you could still see the smoke coming out of his ears. You know, here's a guy who was, you know, I mentioned he was born in Atlanta, people in Kentucky, lived in Nashville, lived in Florida, and had traveled the South for decades, doing civil rights reporting, doing education reporting, doing regular, you know, everyday journalist reporting. These were places he knew. These were places his friends knew. This was his life. And it spoke of two things, I think. The Sterns basically were, they were this kind of imperialistic, almost colonial power, you know, grab for Southern property. In a moment, we're finally starting to realize the value of those places, those barbecue joints, those fried chicken cafes. So, you know, for them to say, no, these are ours, that stance pissed Edgerton off, pissed me off too. And it also, you begin to see new value in those places in this too, because if they're trying to claim them, you realize that knowledge of these, you know, places one would have thought forlorn even a decade or two prior, there's new value for those places, new value in those pitmasters, new value in those fried chicken cooks. So you start to see a change in the way Southerners and outsiders regard that kind of down-home food.
Do you ever think about this idea of, you know, that once you've kind of let everybody know about it, that it sort of changes the place forever in some way, that, you know, once the Sterns or John Edgerton or you even, you know, if you're in the stuff you've written about particular places, I guess maybe the way I'd ask it is, have you ever gone to one of those places, written about it, and then gone back and decided it sort of changed for the worse?
You know, I've thought about this a good bit. You know, to be frank, the places that I've written about, I haven't seen the kind of transformation that worries me. And I don't mean that as false humility. I mean, I don't know how many people read my stuff. I think as a writer, you've got a responsibility to write about places in a certain way. You don't want to set up your readers to be pelt hunters who come in looking for this food. They come in looking for, you know, this is the best fried chicken you can get in the land, and that's what I want you as my reader to get in and get out. That's kind of like booty call journalism. It says, like, you know, what you want is this thing, and then I want you to get out. And I think I try at least to write about places in a way that encourages people to think about the community they call home, the specific history of that restaurant and its family. And if I can call attention to that and a lot of people show up, that's great. I don't know how much impact I've had that way. But as a writer, you know, my responsibility is to tell honest stories that I hope will a Crete to be somehow transformative for my region. And each time I write, I've got a responsibility to steer clear of booty call writing and to move toward, you know, here are issues to consider, here's a place to consider them.
One of the things I think kind of comes through as sort of a sub-theme in your book, and as we've been talking, is who gets to tell the story, you know, and, right. and how that changes, has changed sometimes over time. I think of the story you tell about the woman who cooked for Marjorie Kennan Rawlings.
Mm-hmm. Adela Parker.
Yeah, and how it well, just tell that story real quick.
So Adela Parker was the longtime maid and cook for Marjorie Kennan Rawlings, who we know by way of Cross Creek and the Cross Creek Cookbook, Central Florida writer. And Parker, who worked for her for decades, after Cross Creek is out, after Rawlings has ascended to the pantheon of great writers, Adela Parker writes a book that basically says, you know, everything she knows about cooking, she knows from me. And she does it in a way that is, that's honest and raw. And that emerges at a moment when America is finally reckoning with who the true kind of drivers of Southern cuisine were. And they were, across the full spectrum of the South, they were working class folk. In the deeper South, outside of the mountain South, they were demonstrably people of color. And people of color didn't get their due. But you see this shining, beautiful moment, and you see people like Adela Parker. You also see people like Verda Mae Grosvenor. Grosvenor was from South Carolina. And Grosvenor, in a book called Vibration Cooking, makes a similar argument. Like, you know, and she says it in a kind of in a voice of that moment of the late 1970s, 80s that says, white folks, wake up. You know, this food was born of black folks. That's a conversation we're still embroiled in. That's a conversation that will probably continually, this conversation will probably continually drive Southerners to better understand who we are and where our food came from. The debts have not been paid down yet.
I also think of it, kind of an offshoot of this same topic is this, you know, idea that's come along certainly in the last 20 or 30 years of the kind of the celebrity chef, and then sort of the reaction to kind of what goes on behind the scenes in those places. You know, you wrote about Paula Deen and one of her coworkers who was black, who, and there were issues with things that Paula Deen had said that sort of exposed some ugly stuff in her kitchens. And I also think about the stuff that's just come out about John Besh in New Orleans and, you know, the sort of sexual harassment allegations there. And I just wonder if you see that as kind of a piece in that sort of power imbalance, maybe in the Southern kitchen that's always been there in some way.
That's a great way of thinking about it. I mean, you know, in the case of a celebrity chef, in the case of someone like Besh, it's a gender imbalance. And in the case of Paula Deen, it's a racial imbalance. You know, the place, the kitchen has long been a place of inequity. And that's one of the great underlying threads of the story of Southern food. It's farms were places where labor was forced or coerced, and kitchens remain those same kind of spaces today. That linkage is pretty profound. That's a really smart observation on your part. And I think it's what drives me to write about food, too, is how stark the inequities are and how by apprehending them, you know, in beginning that conversation at table, a seemingly safe place, a seemingly, you know, place without rancor, you quickly get to the rancor, you quickly get to the inequity. It's a great point, Tommy.
I guess I want to stop here for a second and just kind of pull back and say, you know, I think about, you know, Freud saying sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And I wonder for you, having really been thinking about this for a long time in a very deep way, is it possible for you still for like a pork chop just to be a pork chop, you know, or can every time you sit down to eat, is all this other stuff in your head as well?
It's always in my head. You know, I mean, it's the writer in all of us. You know, it's like when I'm eating, I went through Memphis yesterday, and someone had suggested a soul food place called Miss Gurley's to me. And I'd never been. They mentioned that the family that owned Miss Gurley's was descended from some of the men who were part of the Memphis sanitation workers strike that drew Dr. King to Memphis in 68. And that, as we know, that brought King to his death in 68. So what I hear is a place called Miss Gurley's in Memphis. It's associated with the sanitation workers strike, and the food's good. And I went by on my way to that place, and on that same block with that restaurant, there was two doors down a place called the Independent Beauty Salon and Barbershop. And in the back of the Independent Beauty and Barbershop was a soul food cafe called Patricia's. And cat a corner from that was a hot tamale van with a flashing orange light on top and a sign outside that said hot tamales. And when I went inside the convenience store next to the hot tamale van to get cash to buy hot tamales, there was another soul food cafe in there that had the most crazy good macaroni and cheese I've had in a long time. So, like, I just went to go have lunch, and all of a sudden I'm in a vortex of reporting, you know? I mean, that's a beautiful discovery, but I mean, I couldn't just go eat a pork chop at Miss Gurley's, and that's kind of life, you know?
Right, right. And I'm sure you've kind of gotten over this at this point, but I think a lot of people who are just starting to explore this stuff, I think, worry about being, you know, the random white people in a place that's not made for them. And is that something that has gave you any discovery at the beginning? Is it something that you think about at all now?
I mean, it gives me discomfort every time when I mention walking into, you know, these different cafes. So that's four experiences really in about a two block area. The hot tamale guy, I found out through conversation his name. When I asked him if I could take a picture, he's like, man, I don't need no pictures. and I explained to him what I do and how I write. And he said, you know, I don't need pictures. That was all about trust. It was all about whether I belong there. You know, he told me in conversation that I said, how's your business? And he said, it's good at the first of the month, which means when government checks come in, when pensions come in. And he said, it's sorry right now, late in the month. I was in a place where it wasn't as if I wasn't welcome there, but it was not a place where I'm not in a place in my life where I have to worry about when the check comes in at the first of the month.
Right.
When I asked him, you know, if I could take a picture, you know, I didn't try to argue my point when he said no. It's about respect. It's about being willing to listen to people. And it's also about being willing to walk away if you are unwelcome, but be crazily open. So after that exchange with him, I was deflated. I felt like, you know, I'm an intruder. And then I walked in Miss Gurley's, and Aaron Gurley behind the counter just smiled so big at me and looked at me like this white boy was supposed to be walking in right then, and it was his job to make me feel as welcome as he possibly could. I guess my point here is every situation's different. Be open to the experience and be respectful of the response you get. If someone, you know, makes you feel unwelcome, try your best to communicate with them. And if they don't want you in that place, walk away.
Well, the tamale story reminds me that, so this year, I think the big focus of the SFA has been the Latino influence and experience when it comes to Southern food. How did that come about, and why did y'all decide to tell that story now?
Well, we usually set our programming for the Southern PLA Alliance on a 5-year cycle. So, you know, I can tell you that next year we're focusing on food and literature, and the year after that we're focusing on food and labor. And this year has all been the Latino South. So we vary the themes based on what we see the direction of the South being and what issues we think have been overlooked. And so we set this theme, the Latino South theme, about 5 years ago, really just thinking about demographics and thinking about what the South is becoming, who the South is becoming, and a want to be as honest about as we can about who the South is now. You know, if you're paying attention to demographic trends, migration trends, the South is being transformed by Latino migration. And so, I mean, that just told us we need to focus there. Also, we looked at our recent oral history work and film work, and so much of it was about kind of 21st century Southerners, new arrivals who were fashioning their own kind of Southern identity. And that continues to fascinate me, even though this book we've talked about in part today is a history, you know, that goes from 55 to 2015. I'm really interested in this kind of present tense South that wherein our ideas about what Southern food is are changing pretty rapidly. So that leads us straight to this notion of the Latino South. And it gets us to, you know, you were in the audience during the Charlotte event. Someone like Pico Iwudzi, who teaches up at Davidson, you know, Pico asking that kind of elemental question about deportations of Mexican Americans and other Latinos. He asked, what would happen if instead of talking about they are being deported, Southerners said we are being deported, with reference to ICE raids and others? Just the shift in pronoun is what I hope we might make some small step towards correcting, toward driving. Because that's what's happened for me, is the recognition that the South is Latino. It's not exceptional. It's not something that's been visited upon the South. You know, our food is harvested by, cooked by, served by Latino peoples. And it's appropriate that we pay homage to that.
And what are some things that maybe you've learned during this year of kind of focusing on those things?
One of the things that's fascinating at our fall symposium, which was just a few weeks ago, I work with the speakers to edit their pieces. And in years past, we've had some issues with, you know, with white, especially working class Southerners who wanted to talk, and they always talked about their grandmama. You know, they began and ended a scholarly talk by talking about their grandmama. And it, you know, it gets a little wearying sometimes. Like, I know, get me to the real heart of the talk. I know you love your grandmama, and I don't mean to disparage your grandmama, but there's too much grandmama talk.
Like 3 grandmamas per weekend, right?
Yeah, and 1 mamaw and peepaw and 3 grandmamas, yeah. The remarkable thing, as an editor who works with speakers over a range of time for the Southern Foodways Alliance, I'm accustomed to saying, you know, you speaker, you know, from Southwest Florida, you speaker from Northeastern Tennessee, you know, you opened your talk and you closed your talk about your grandmama, and so did 2 other speakers, and somebody, we got to lose some grandmamas here, you know? And the remarkable thing was when we booked a cadre of Latino speakers, and everyone who spoke at our fall symposium was of Latino origin, more Latino speakers did the grandmama thing than people from the hills of Tennessee who have 5 generations deep Anglo-Saxon blood. Like, there was those commonalities that were unexpected shine through. There's a real sense of a dedication to kind of matrilineal connections. There was a real sense of a connection to place and a claiming of the South that was active, that was beautiful. It didn't so much surprise me as affirm to me that Latino identity in the South is is vibrant and is really in this moment defining of what the South is.
I want to wrap up by asking something in this idea of immigration made me think about this, that, you know, they're obviously beyond people just coming here from other countries. Now that this in this country that people are so much more mobile, there are a lot of people and who live in the South now who come from other parts of this country. I mean, you can find a Buffalo Bills bar in every town in the South. And in the same way, people from the South have obviously, you know, from not just the Great Migration, but all kinds of people we've all kind of blended and mixed. And in your book, you talk about a lot of these cultural things in the South that have sort of become nationwide things from, you know, back as far as like Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, that's obviously like a global thing now. And I guess what I'm trying to get around to is the question, do you think that the rest of the country has become more like us, or have we become more like them?
Well, it brings me back to an Edgerton book, which was The Southernization of America or The Americanization of the South. You know, that was the basic question he asked. And I think what we're observing now in terms of politics, religion, cultural expression is the ways that the South imprints on the country as a whole. And for good and ill, I think we're seeing that. I also think we're seeing, to your point about people from outside the American South coming here, we see people from New York moving to New Orleans. We see people from Chicago moving to Nashville. We see people from San Francisco moving to Atlanta. And they come in search of some kind of American taproot. They come in search of some kind of unvarnished America, unspoiled by modernity. Now, I'm not saying they're going to find that, but I think those two things are happening at the same time. There's a spread of Southern culture and a stamp upon America of Southern life. And at the same time, we see people from outside the region coming here looking for kind of America, looking for this kind of Harry Smith basement tapes America. And that drives an ongoing fascination and is the reason that, you know, a podcast like yours will be heard all across the country, because people are trying to figure us out. And we will never quit trying to figure ourselves out.
I guess I do have one little quick follow-up to that. Do you think that sort of the thing that you say people are coming here to look for, does it still exist? And is it okay if it doesn't?
I think to varying degrees, it still exists. Like I just talked about that Memphis moment.
Right.
You know, to walk into Miss Gurley's Soul Food, which has been open for 30 years, and I'd never stepped foot in until yesterday. And in a way, my cross of that transom was a step into some kind of Memphis past, you know, that ties to the Memphis sanitation worker strike, the menu of oxtails and dressing. And so I'm looking for that past and the present, too, no matter how much I may want to think myself the 21st century Southerner fixed on the ways that Carnitas tortas in Gulfport, Mississippi are being marketed as Mexican po' boys. I've got both those things in my head. And I guess what I'm saying is you can have both. Those two things can coexist. There can be a South that's very much grounded in the past and is resonant historically, culturally. You can taste it. You can feel it. And at the same time, there's this rapidly changing South along Buford Highway in Atlanta and 100 other places wherein the shape-shifting South continues to shift. Both are possible. They don't cancel each other out. We can dig deep into our past and embrace a multicultural future. And in those tensions, I think, resides beauty.
John T., thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Tommy.
Thanks to John T. Edge for talking to us today. If you're interested in the Southern Foodways Alliance, and you should be, you can find out more at southernfoodways.org. One warning, do not look at that site or read John T.'s book if you're hungry. Southbound is a production of WFAE. The producer is Nick Della Canal, and WFAE's news director is Greg Collard. If you have any thoughts about the show, suggestions for future guests, or deep feelings about whether you say it pecan or pecan, email me at tomlinsonwrites@gmail.com. You can find this show and other episodes of Southbound at WFAE.org, the WFAE app, and other places where you find podcasts. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.